from 88.7 FM WXDU Durham and available via podcast on the World Wide Web. This is Shooting the Bull, your weekly survey of what's happening in the Bull City, brought to you by the voices of the Durham blogosphere. The opinions expressed on this program belong to the individuals expressing them and do not necessarily reflect those of WXDU or Duke University.
Good evening, folks. I'm Kevin Davis with BullCityRising.com.
I'm Barry Reagan. I write at dependableerection.blogspot.com. Welcome to Shooting the Bull for Thursday, March 19th. We are 12 hours away from the first day of spring.
And we are 12 hours in, more or less, into March Madness, I think.
Yeah, something happened. You know, I was looking.
Everyone's talking basketball scores. I'm not really sure what's going on here.
I was looking for the elimination game in the World Baseball Classic the other night.
When Good luck with that.
When the U.S. was playing Puerto Rico, and I'm looking through all of the ESPN channels, and they're showing basketball except for ESPN Classic, which had an old rerun of a PBA, Professional Bowlers Association event. And eventually I discovered that MLB TV is available during the World Baseball Classic, so I was able to watch the last five innings, including the thrilling comeback in the bottom of the ninth inning for the United States to make it to the semifinals for the first time in this event. So.
You either needed MLB Network or the Ocho if you were going to try and get the if you were going to try and get that game.
It's a shame. It's a shame that baseball is America's pastime, and the World Baseball Classic should be one of the premier events in the sporting world. And boy, it wasn't.
Well, it is a new event. It will take some time to take off. You know, Barry, we didn't put this on our list of show topics for tonight, but since you brought up baseball, and since the Durham Bulls will start their season soon, I've been meaning to blog about this week, but there is a small controversy related to one of our finest AAA players who may be back this season, David Price.
Fill me in.
The pitcher. David Price has understandably expressed concern that the Rays might relegate him to AAA for some time to mature as a player, i.e. they could keep him under contract longer at a lower salary, which would be great for Durhamites. I mean, to get to see the man-child pitch some more. I mean, this guy shut down Boston in the ALCS this past year. It'd be fantastic to see David Price on the mound getting to blow away the Gwinnett County Braves or whoever we're playing this year, or the Iron Pigs, but we'll have to see if Mr. Price, the Vanderbilt graduate, wants to come back here and fight for name recognition with our congressman again.
My suspicion is that the American League East is going to be so competitive that they won't be able to keep him down here for not very long. But you can probably hear more on the sports show on Sunday night.
And, we're amateurs when it comes to sports, folks.
Well, speak for yourself.
So
Kevin,
you
barely made it to the studio again tonight. And folks, I want to let you know, we spent the whole day lining up guests for the entire month of April. and we have some great guests lined up.
Just wait till April.
But tonight, you're going to be entertained by Kevin and I talking about Durham politics and local issues. Now, you were down in South Durham at the county commissioner's meeting on Jordan Lake and this is not the Jordan Lake rules. This is the survey that was done. No, both.
Now, this slightly different.
More,
there were
less?
Multiple issues. I left only about 35 minutes in. Look for Matt Milliken and Jim Wise to have pieces in the Herald Sun and the N&O shortly on this. They were still there. The meeting was called in general to talk about growth in South Durham. Melissa Rooney, who is a perennial commenter on issues of growth down in South Durham, this was held in Fairfield, one of the neighborhoods down there. I have to say, I felt like I'd driven into a part of Cary. It was very odd for me as a downtowner to go to this part of South Durham where it's farms and subdivisions. It's the strangest thing. But the meeting had Steve Medlin, who is the city county planning director. Joe Colopy, who's one of the planners there, who's been working on the issue of the urban growth area, which was one of the main topics that the meeting was starting on, although it was getting into other topics as I was leaving. Becky Heron was there, county commissioner, who's been a big advocate for protecting rural and sensitive areas. George Bryan, the planning commission chair, was there. So there were some notables in the audience.
So this was not a county commissioner's hearing. I thought what I had read was this was a meeting being held by.
It had different purposes. One reason for it is that the Joint City-County Planning Commission, which includes Brian, it includes some county commissioners and some city councilmen, they've been debating this question of moving the urban growth area, the urban growth boundary. And this is a boundary that basically denotes where sewer service will be extended. And currently in the south, roughly southeastern part of, southeastern central part of Durham, away from the area that's been discussed around the Jordan Lake 751 Fayetteville project, in that area right now, the urban growth area extends all the way to the Chatham County line. And the proposal here is to bring it up, basically exempting some Durham County Natural Inventory areas and some Army Corps of Engineers areas as being outside the UGA. By being outside the UGA, Barry, they basically couldn't bring sewer service in there. And if you can't bring sewer service in, if you're going to develop, you've got to develop on septic and water.
Which means densities are going to be lower.
Right.
And you have to have land that actually perks. Right. And,
exactly.
And that makes development a much riskier issue then.
So to that end, essentially the JCCPC has heard this issue a couple of times and has decided to hold this as sort of one way of getting some feedback. It's coming back before JCCPC, I think, on April 1st. So the topic's by no means done, but this was basically a chance to mostly get feedback. As I was leaving, they were starting to talk a bit about, and Steve Medlin was giving the backstory that you've probably read in Matt Saldana's pieces in the Indy and in the Herald Sun and elsewhere, about the Jordan Lake 751 Fayetteville assemblage, this project where there was a privately paid-for survey of the Jordan Lake critical watershed boundary through one individual parcel, one very large parcel, that ended up changing the boundaries. And Steve Medlin reiterated tonight that they are planning to move forward with neighborhood meetings, move forward with the comp plan review, move forward with rezoning, et cetera. Of course, there's been some debate about whether that was necessary or not. The Indies covered that very well.
Now, when you say move forward, right, do you mean that moving forward, accepting the new boundary?
No, moving forward as in look for more public meetings to come on that topic.
Okay, so that the boundary has not yet been finalized and accepted, despite state DWQ saying that Frank Duke's acceptance of the boundary was legitimate.
And there's going to be a public hearing. Oh, no, I'm sorry, not a public hearing. A county commission work session this Monday, from I believe 3:30 to 6 or 6:30, to discuss this. And then it will be on the. There won't be public comment there, but there will be a discussion of the matter. Then it will be on the next, I believe, the next county commission regular public meeting, when there will be more public discussion and debate. But basically, they're looking at making the comp plan change, making the zoning change, and going through the public comment process around that. There has been some debate. Supporters of the project have said that no such meetings are necessary because of the nature of the DWQ ruling. But at least as of Steve Medlin's comments tonight, this is moving forward through that public process.
All right, very interesting. You know, I do want to take a minute to remind folks that we did a 3-week slog through the stormwater issue. And if you missed that, or if you want to listen to it again, it is available on podcast via the iTunes store. You can go to iTunes.com and search on Shooting the Bull, and you'll find our podcast, and you can listen to those episodes and pretty much every show that we've done for the last. We're coming up on our 10-month anniversary, which
that's
is
very
longer.
True.
Well, I'm not going. Speaking of stormwater and such, one of the things that we talked about during our shows was the donut hole, right? Which is the gap in stormwater regulations for part of Durham, including much of downtown, and I guess going up to I-85 on the north, and maybe down to 147 or so, maybe a little bit past there on the south, where there are stormwater regulations regarding development in the Neuse River Basin and in the Cape Fear River Basin, but in the downtown, which doesn't fall into the critical watershed area for either of those, somehow there were no protections in effect, and the city was looking at $25,000 a day fines, beginning, depending on who you talk to, July 1st or April 1st. But city council has taken the bull by the horns, as it were, and city council has made the move and is. Has passed the necessary regulations, according to what I was reading in the paper today, and we now have stormwater controls. or people who develop downtown are able to mitigate their stormwater, what they're putting into the stormwater system by buying conservation mm-hmm. easements downstream and keeping land out of development that way.
And we haven't seen, I think, the full analysis of all the parts of the rule. There was a lot of confusion in press accounts, media accounts, my own included. I think Matt Saldana did some of the best work on this topic with the Indy. And at one point, he had suggested that it could mostly be mitigated off-site if you're in super dense areas like downtown, but there might be some on-site required. I think the Herald Sun quoted an estimate that for the $45 million DPAC project, the Performing Arts Center, it could have been done for about $40,000, $45,000, $50,000. But they also had a lot of land to work with. We don't know yet how this is going to shake out. And, of course, you know, there's such a booming development market right now with free-flowing money from banks that it will be a while until we actually see what's going to happen with this.
Believe it or not, I was in Raleigh last night. Drove back through Cary, and there's plenty of construction going on in the Triangle. I don't know. I haven't really been out of the state except up to D.C. In the past 5 or 6 months. I haven't really traveled around the country. I don't know what it's like firsthand. You know.
Well, we did find out in today's paper that the Raleigh-Cary MSA is the fastest growing metropolitan area in the country from July 07 to July 08. And Durham MSA, which is Durham and Chapel Hill, was not ranked. But the NNO's growth chart showed that we're about 2.5% growth. Raleigh-Cary was at 4.3. But Raleigh-Cary's down a little bit over the past year. Durham's growth has been sort of steadily increasing throughout the decade. So,
and you look at some other fast-growing MSAs like Phoenix or Las Vegas and stuff, and they're probably at negative growth rates right now.
I was going to say, you know? for 07 to 08, they actually were in the top. I think Austin was number two. And there's huge slides from basically Boise through Salt Lake City down through the Mountain West, Provo, Utah, places like that. We're in the top. Charlotte ranked seventh in the survey. Palm Beach ranked fourth. I guess who knows? Madoff hadn't tanked yet. So,
folks, you're listening to Shooting the Bull on WXDU Durham. I'm Barry Reagan.
I'm Kevin Davis, and you are here listening to Barry and myself tonight, chatting on topics of local news. So we'll be back with some special guests next week. I think, Barry, next we're going to turn to the question of some recycling changes that appeared before City Council at their work session today.
I don't know how you do it.
I read the website.
You had a blog post up almost immediately.
It's on the website. No one bothers to go out and look at the City Council agendas.
The City Council's website is at durhamnc.gov/council.
Now, I love this. The agendas are durhamnc.gov/agendas, which is just a wonderful URL if you think of all the agendas of those in and near politics.
But they actually post the discussions pretty much as they happen?
They post what it is, Barry, is they post the items that are going to be on the following week's agendas for the Monday and Thursday meetings and the attachments. They actually do a better job at it than the county does.
So you got a chance to read Donald Long's presentation before he made it, but we don't know yet what the response on council was.
Well, at least neither of us were at the City Council work session today, which are not televised or streamed at this point.
The work sessions. So anyway, the proposal is as I understand it, to do away with some of the large dumpsters that businesses currently contract with through the city, and push businesses to their own private contracting for picking up that waste, and use that staff to implement an increased recycling program throughout the city of Durham.
That's exactly it. The back in the 90s, dumpster collection, I guess, had been free. And I guess the businesses owned the dumpsters, but they were, you know, the city was coming along and picking them up and taking their trash away for free. That moved then to a charge model that was used to initiate the recycling program in the first place. So the proposal here is to eliminate city pickup of dumpsters entirely. Businesses would contract for that. And instead, you would end up with a curbside recycling pickup, which we have today. What they would do is move from the little bins that don't allow you to necessarily put all your recycling in to larger bins, 65 to 95 gallon roll carts, like your yard waste or your trash bins, and they would come every other week to pick up your recycling. And commenters on over at Bull City Rising today raised the fear of how do you know what your week is, but someone who's in the pilot program says actually it's worked out pretty well. So the net savings on this could be as much about $500,000 over the current world, given the fact that we're losing money each year on the dumpster pickup, and we're paying $2.1 million to Tidewater Fiber Corporation to pick up our recycling and do that. Wait a second.
We pay an outside party to pick up our recycling, and who gets the money from the recycled goods?
Well, this
goes to Tidewater, or does that come back to the city?
This is one of the reasons. You know, it's not like, Barry, everyone just got the environmental bug 20 years ago and started recycling programs for the good of it, right? The whole way that recycling programs typically work is cities have usually paid a company like TFC to come along and pick up the recycling. What they do is the companies give them a lower rate than they would pay for being able to on a per pound basis, dispose of solid waste. Because the idea is basically the company picks up the recyclables, recycles them, sells them off in the plastics and aluminums market. But it's still cheaper for the city to pay for them to pick up recycling than it would be to have all of that mass, all that tonnage, go into the solid waste stream. So basically, yeah, they sell the material, they keep some money out of it, passes along a lower rate to the city.
So this change would capture that revenue stream that we are now currently paying to a third party. And, you know, because we have the people on staff already, they're doing other work.
Yeah.
And they'd come back and they would be switched over to this job. So there'd be no increase in the budget, and theoretically we would be spending less money.
Although I have to say, I'd be intrigued to see if anyone's done the analysis, and presumably the city has, on the impact of keeping the contract and just ending the dumpster pickup, which, you know, is a rough thing to say, obviously, in these tough economic times. But I would be surprised if that wasn't a question that comes up from council or from citizens.
Have you had a chance to look at other cities in North Carolina and how many of them are providing dumpster pickup for businesses? I know in a lot of cities that I've lived, that's not the case. So, you know, we may be moving to something that's more closely in line with what other municipalities are doing, and I will try to get a chance to look at that, and if I do start blogging again, that'll be something yeah. Interesting to look at.
I've got to say that the big advantage I would just love about this change is, like a lot of people, we leave our recycling bin outside, but then you don't want to fill it with cardboard and plastics and aluminum all week long, and the rain gets in and it gets nasty. So we actually have an indoor bin that we keep our recycling in, and once a week we go and transfer it to the outdoor bin, and it's just kind of a pain. So the idea of being able to...
We put the glass and the plastic and the very few aluminum cans that we actually go through outside in the bin during the week. I keep all the paper, all my mixed paper, inside in a separate bin, which fills up
you know,
pretty much every week, and we just lug that out to the curb and have multiple bins. You know, one thing that people have talked about on my listserv in Duke Park, and I think on the Inner Neighborhood Council listserv, I don't know if you've seen this over in Trinity Park, there's a population of folks in Durham who, supplement their income by walking or driving through neighborhoods the night before trash pickup and emptying the aluminum cans out of recycling bins, because aluminum is the easiest of the recyclable materials to actually take to a recycling center and get money for.
Yeah.
If we move to a rollout cart, 90-gallon rollout cart, what does that do?
Well, I wonder. Maybe you'll have some extra trash vans, pickup trucks that they could pool their money, buy one, and go around and pick up the bins?
If they pick up the entire bin, you know, but I mean, if you start going through the bin looking just for the aluminum cans, and you've got a 90-gallon mixed recycling thing.
And the mixed is important, by the way, because, you know, in theory right now you're supposed to separate your recyclables in the bin, although I don't think it happens frequently. They do that when they pick it up. They put them in the right slots.
Right. I've asked my recycling guys, like, hey, I'm sorry, you know, I've got this in the same bin as that, and I've always been told don't worry about it. I try to keep my cardboard and paper in one place.
And this would actually mix to single-stream recycling, as it's called, in which case you're encouraged. Just put it all in the bin. Doesn't matter what it is. You know, the idea is make it easier for people to recycle so more people recycle.
Yeah, well, let's say I'm Donald Long, our director of solid waste management, has had some very good ideas. He hasn't been able to get them all implemented in times of tight budget. So we'll be watching to see what happens with this as the budget cycle goes through to budget passage in late May or early June. You know, another thing that council addressed today is, and this probably resonates with you because you're a resident of the neighborhood involved or nearby resident, is the party houses in Trinity Heights, basically a stone's throw from the studio that we are broadcasting from. I mean, Trinity Heights right across
right.
Markham Avenue.
So residents of the Trinity Heights neighborhood have been raising the issue consistently over the last couple of years, especially since the party problem in Trinity Park sort of died down as Duke bought out some of the houses, and more of the houses have gone to sort of large rental house models in Trinity Heights, which is between Walltown and Duke's East Campus. And residents have been encouraging the administration to become more involved. A lot of this started back when President Cohen, back in the 90s, tried to crack down on on-campus drinking, which was not strictly a Duke phenomenon. There was a lot of pressure from the, as I understand it, the first Bush administration and the Clintons on financial aid policies and cracking down on institutions that didn't enforce the drinking law. So you had a lot of institutions. My own undergraduate alma mater did the same thing at the same time.
And interesting, a lot of university presidents are going on record now as saying they would like to see the drinking age lowered, you know, back down to 19 or even 18.
And you know, I mean, we could have a whole show on about the challenges of sort of the underage binge drinking that you're seeing. But in short, the Trinity Heights residents have been pushing for Duke to take a more active role in this. And there's sort of this feeling among the Trinity Heights residents in their petitions and their messages to council that the university sort of may feel like it's just sort of obviated itself from the problem by letting these students move off campus. I think the university would probably disagree. Just a note for conflict of interest. I myself work for the university, but in no way related to this matter. One of the things that kicked off this discussion, sort of an ad hoc discussion today at council, and I'll be blogging about this tomorrow, is an email from a Duke faculty member who witnessed at the end of spring break this sort of en masse return of students to one of the party houses. You know, allegations of, you know, were there intoxicated people around on the street making too much noise? Were people driving who shouldn't have been driving? Blocking the street, getting out, making all kinds of noise at, you know, the o-dark 30 hours of early morning. And the police were called and you know, did their business. But a couple of council members drove by the site, you know, after this event, after hearing from the neighbors, and apparently saw a tremendous amount of refuse outside a house on Clarendon Street in the 800 block of Clarendon. And this made it onto the agenda today. And apparently the council spent more than an hour on this item talking about it with some heat from council members. At least Eugene Brown was quoted in the In and O's blog as saying, basically, you know, we're going to skip Dr. Mineta, the head of student affairs. This needs to go straight to Dick Broadhead. There needs to be university attention on this. And to my mind, this is really the potential turn up of the heat on this issue.
I believe Eugene's quote directly was that Larry Mineta and Duke student affairs are part of the problem. And that was an interesting quote to read. And you know, I mean, you say as a Trinity Park resident that after those dozen or so houses were purchased by the university, taken out of the student rental market, that the problem you know in Trinity Park has diminished greatly. There are far fewer complaints about party houses, noise violations.
There's less. You know, oil encapsulated wrestling and bikinis happening.
Fewer vomiting in people's bushes.
Or throwing beer bottles at residents. It's changed dramatically.
So you know, it's interesting because I had a conversation with somebody just yesterday, an email conversation about this. We were talking about the neighborhood that I live in and some of the difficulties we get in having the city respond to some of our complaints. And, you know, the Trinity Park model, you know, was raised as to, well, how did Trinity Park solve this issue with, you know, getting the city involved and working with the university, you know, and stuff like that. And it was just interesting. And one of the things that I said was, you know, it may just be that what Trinity Park succeeded in doing was transferring the problem to another, you know, geographic location. And I had no idea that this was on the agenda for city council today and that it had become, you know, such a heated problem. But listening to the complaints of the people who live in Trinity Heights about this, you know, what a profound sense of deja vu. I mean, it's exactly what we were reading 4 and 5 years ago from people who live, mm-hmm. you know, just off of East Campus.
And it's worth mentioning that the vast majority of students who live off campus are wonderful neighbors, wonderful participants in the community. I knew some undergraduates and graduate students who lived in the neighborhood, lived near me, and just great to have as neighbors, you know, tried to get active in the school, got active in the community. There is this discussion. You know, I have my own thoughts on it that I tend not to blog on, but about is the character the fundamental character of Duke undergraduate life different than that at other schools? And you see a lot of different opinions. You know, sometimes I think sort of the anti-Trinity Park meme that you hear is, you know, why'd you live near a college? Of course college students are going to be out drinking and partying and being loud and having a good time. I mean, that doesn't resonate with my own undergraduate experience or I think most of Duke's peer schools. And I think there's some fertile ground to be mined in terms of just how different is the Duke experience from its peer institutions.
I certainly had some of that when I was an undergraduate. But when I lived off campus as an undergraduate, I lived in an apartment that was all, other students. And we really didn't have other neighbors that we were disturbing. And then when I did eventually, you know, go to grad school and live in a house with other folks, I became a much better neighbor.
Well, you know? Barry, you know, you went to Budweiser State for undergraduate, and you went to Cabernet University
I graduated from Stony Brook University, which at the time was called the State University of New York at Stony Brook. And the house I lived in when I was in grad school was right on the beach. It was just a beautiful house.
I'm sure you did a lot of studying.
It was I did as much studying as I possibly could, enough to graduate. But yeah, that's an interesting. I mean, just some almost incendiary quotes from some city council people today, and I'm looking forward to see how that plays out over the next couple of months.
It will be interesting.
Yeah, you know, especially there'll be a break over the summer, and then the students will come back in the fall, and we'll see if any changes are made. We'll see how President Broadhead decides to address this gauntlet that has been thrown down in front of his feet by city council.
And this will also be an interesting test for, you know, one name that didn't come up, at least in the blog posts, Dr. Phil Wynn, who is the new, I believe, vice president over community engagement or vice president for Duke Durham Affairs. So we'll be, so far, you know, his office is fairly new and is integrated in different ways with community affairs on campus, which previously community affairs and the Duke Durham Neighborhood Partnership had a big role in these issues. It'll be very interesting to see how Dr. Wynn gets involved.
I thought specifically that was part of his portfolio. When he was hired, I seem to remember reading that in the paper that was part of his job. Anyway, we're approaching the 8 o'clock hour. We had one or two more things that we want to talk about tonight. You know, one of my favorite places in Durham, and this is a purely unsolicited opinion and a personal opinion, is the Broad Street Cafe. It's right around the corner from our studio. It's about a mile from here. In fact, I'm probably going to be there in about 20 minutes.
All you crazy stalkers can go hit Barry up at Broad Street Cafe.
But one of Broad Street Cafe's neighbors has filed a multi-million dollar.
You're conflating
did
the issue.
Hear? Okay.
Straight
me out here. I thought I heard some. I heard some god awful number thrown around.
No. So a person who lives near Broad Street Cafe actually owns two properties, lives in one, and I think rents out some room in that one, and rents out the other house on Clarendon. Lives near the side of Broad Street Cafe. Separately, this individual has filed, a lawsuit against the city and the police department last year.
Got it.
Unclear for what purposes, but on earlier this month, petitioned city council and appeared before city council this week on Thursday, talk about noise and parking issues around Broad Street Cafe, claiming that vehicles from people attending events at Broad Street were being parked outside the house, blocking the driveway. The individuals called the police in the past on when these situations have arisen. Apparently wasn't satisfied with the response he got from the police. Broad Street Cafe's owners, when my correspondent, Barry, actually went to talk to Broad Street about it, they weren't aware of this. They hadn't seen it on the city council agenda. So I'm not sure if they were at the meeting today or not. They said they were going to reach out to this individual. But, you know, the question it raises in my mind, I mean, you're always going to have disagreements with neighbors, is a really interesting question around the fact that this was originally a Revco drugstore. So the neighbors who moved in there's a drugstore. And I love Broad Street Cafe. I love Watts Grocery. But, you know, it does raise a question that suddenly this commercial use morphed into another commercial use. Presumably we'll hear something about planning about it.
Well, it's been over 5 years since the BSC was a drugstore, and maybe even longer than that, because it went through an incarnation as Ooh La Latte, mm-hmm. and the Untidy Museum for a couple of years before it became the Broad Street Cafe. It may even go back 6 or 7 years that it's been there. So yeah, there are people who have been there, whose residence predates its use as an entertainment venue, but a good many people live there because you now have, you know, on North Broad Street, mm-hmm. And almost an entertainment district.
Exactly.
And you have, you know, literally hundreds of people, maybe even 1,000 or 2,000 people who live within walking distance.
Absolutely.
Of this area. And that is, for many people, a draw. You know, people want to live where they can walk to, walk to entertainment at night. And hey, you know, if you want to have an extra beer,
you can walk right home. I met someone there for a drink yesterday, and I, you know, after we had dinner, I got in my car and they got on their feet and walked home. It's a great area.
Right. So we are just about out of time. I think next week we're going to be talking about food, aren't we?
I believe we are.
Yeah,
the folks from Carpe Durham are lined up to join us, one of the great food blogs here in town.
So tune in for that. In the meantime, I'm Barry Reagan. I write at dependableerection.blogspot.com.
I'm Kevin Davis. I write at bullcityrising.com. Have a great week, and we'll see you here next week.
You're listening to WXDU Durham.